if you're not taking some space and time to reflect on where are we trying to go, what are we doing, is that helping us get there, what's my role in this, how are my behaviors helping or not, you know, as a senior leader, if you're not doing that, no one's doing that. We have to create space for that type of thinking. And that leads on to then creating some space and time for innovation and exploration.
Welcome to the Innovation Metrics Podcast, where we bring you the latest on innovation management. We provide insights on how to measure innovation, innovation accounting, and managing the uncertain process of developing new, sustainable, and profitable business models. You can find links to the main topics covered in this episode and information about the guests and hosts in the show notes, or go to our blog on innovationmetrics.co. Your host is Aaliyah Eilert.
In this episode, I'm excited to welcome Susie Brahm on the show. Susie is an entrepreneur and expert in corporate innovation, strategy, and leadership. Former head of innovation and entrepreneurship in the UK national security arena, Susie now coaches executives and provides advice on business model development and innovation ecosystems. We're going to talk about why people keep going in difficult roles corporate innovation leaders often find themselves in, how to spot the right people for the job, how to support them, and how they can support themselves and each other.
Hi, Susie. Welcome on the show.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here, and I'm really pleased that you asked me to come along and talk. Very excited to share some of my thoughts.
Yeah, equally. I'm very, very, very happy to have you here. Mm. Do you want to start off by telling us a bit about yourself?
Yeah, awesome. So, right now, I set up two businesses around 2020, actually. The first was Yellow Cat, which is an innovation training, coaching, and consultancy business, which I co-founded with a former colleague of mine, Katie Careless. We set that up really because, and I think it's one of the things we're going to talk about today, because when I was started leading innovation and was fairly new to it, one of the things that I found really challenging was finding people who could really relate to what I was going through. So not just give me the sort of best practice, but really kind of empathize with some of the challenges I was facing. So that was sort of a really strong motivation for us to set up Yellow Cat, to share our experience and help people that were going through similar things to what we did. And I also set up Mulberry Retreats, which is a company that does leadership development, takes a very holistic approach to leadership development in a retreat setting. So the sort of connection to nature and the connection to people and each other and the reconnection to ourselves is really important there. And that really emerged from a lot of the work that I was doing around innovation in organizations, both, I guess, my own journey, but also the other journey I saw people going on, and around some of the challenges leaders face with leading innovation, and how, even with the best will in the world, in the kind of cultures they were working in, and the way they'd kind of been brought up to lead and manage, how difficult it was to sort of overcome some of those really deep-seated learned behaviors and mindsets, and how actually people need to do a much sort of deeper level of work on themselves to really make the change they needed. So that's what I'm doing now.
You had your corporate career before, I suppose.
So I spent 19 years working for the British government. So I spent nearly all of that time kind of in the national security business, working for the Ministry of Defence and the Foreign Office. And I did a wide variety of jobs, actually, in the early part of my career. I guess it was around 7 or 8 years ago now. A deputy director at the time, who I'd worked with previously, he was a very visionary individual, bit of a Marmite character, actually. People either loved or hated him. But he was definitely one of the most sort of forward-thinking people I'd seen at the organisation. But really, he wanted to create a new unit to look at how we did operational capability development for the Ministry of Defence. And at that point, his vision really was just kind of, we need to be more strategic and we need to be more creative and innovative about how we go about it, as opposed to sort of quite tactical and responsive. He was very interested in emerging technologies and he wanted to make sort of better use of bringing those into government as well. And he asked me to help set him this unit up with one other individual, and he asked me to lead on the innovation. And I always remember my first response to this was, I think you've got the wrong person because I can't even draw a stick figure. And he just looked at me and he was like, I don't think that's what innovation is about. And I was like, oh, okay. Anyhow, and I always think it's really interesting about why did he ask me to do that job? And I guess, you know, the more I've learned, because quite often people say to me, you know, like, you need this type of person on your team if you're doing innovation. And it's not about the skill, actually, that they've got at that point. They can learn all of that. It's really about the mindset. And I guess what he saw in me and what I look for in people is, you know, that natural curiosity, the sort of the wanting things to be better, and yeah, open-mindedness, you know, people who can collaborate easily. And I guess that's what he saw. And anyhow, yeah, so we set this unit up. He said to me, I don't want to see anything from you for the first 6 months, just go learn. So I went and learned, which is, again, a pretty unusual thing for anyone to be given the opportunity to do. So I went and spent time with different companies, different parts of government, both here and in the States, actually, and learned about people who were on their innovation journeys, but further ahead than what we were. Understood like different types of innovation. What do people mean by open innovation? What were incubators? What were accelerators? I started to learn about all these things, went to conferences, started reading loads. And I came back and I was kind of, I'd really had my eyes opened, and it was almost like, you know, I'd always been sleepwalking, I suppose. And like maybe I'd had sort of an unease that things could be better than they were or different to how they were. But I guess I didn't have the tools at my disposal to sort of figure out how to make change. And I'd started to really have my eyes open to that. And I'd been absolutely kind of inspired, I suppose, by some of the stories that I'd heard. But what I did really was come back with loads of buzzwords and not really much of an idea as to what they actually meant in practice and how to implement them in the context of the organization that I was working in. But I came back and I started to try different sort of ways of working out. And one of the responses was to set up an incubator to look at some of the most challenging problems at that point in national security. So kind of problems that we'd had for some time. Myself and a colleague were asked to set these incubators up, and they were multi-agency, multidisciplinary teams. And it was exactly how you would not want to do something like this, because it was high profile, high interest, high stakes. And we were exploring, you know, a completely different way of working on these problems. But I would say my learning curve was sort of steep, and at that point it pretty much went vertical. It was one of the most difficult, one of the most incredible, most memorable experiences of my career. I was fortunate to have the most amazing team to work with on it. And it was definitely the team, as opposed to my leadership, that got me through. And it absolutely gave me an opportunity as well to put into practice and everything I've been learning about and figure out how do we make this real. And then in 2018 to 2021, I then went to the Foreign Office to be head of innovation. And that was really good for me because it was a sort of broadening, I suppose, of my scope in a way. So I had an organization-wide remit there and was focused on strategic innovation and in developing the innovation capability of the entire organization. So that just gave me, I guess, a little bit more kind of, I felt more empowered, actually. I also found the organisation, as I went to it, just a little bit more receptive in terms of recognising to some extent the pressures they were under and the need for different thinking and someone to help them with that. So that was an incredible experience. Did that for 3 years. And then since 2021, I advise part-time as well, continue to advise part-time on digital transformation, working very closely with a mixed across organization senior leadership team to realize transformational outcomes. And what are those transformational outcomes that we're trying to achieve? Who are they for? Why are they needed? And really use that to drive what's being done. So that's me. So plenty going on.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you. What we want to explore a bit more, why do people keep going in very difficult jobs in innovation? I think that's what we want to explore today a bit more.
Yeah.
Maybe before we go, or maybe a good pathway to go into that. So with the retreats you're doing for leadership, I'm pretty sure you're addressing parts of this topic there, and I'm like, I wonder how you go about it in your retreats. Maybe to zoom out for a second though, so we both believe, or it seems to be common knowledge, that being an innovator in large organizations and in government particularly, maybe, but there might not be a big difference sometimes in corporates or in governments.
Much less of a difference than, you would think, actually.
Yeah. You quoted in our last chat, you said it can be career suicide, right? Mm. And that really stuck. Like, thought about it several times. It's like, it's a really good way of summing it up.
Right? Yeah.
So why is that so?
Yeah.
And why are people still doing it?
Yeah.
Maybe. And from your perspective. And
And
it sounds, and how do you address that in your, now I'm giving you four questions. I think that's quite unprofessional. Yeah. And how do you how do you address parts of that in your retreats?
Yeah.
To kick it off. Yeah.
So I guess, what's, I think, maybe worth reflecting on, I guess, is that journey I went through, particularly from that first role I did to the second role, and what I learned about myself and others in leadership positions. So I mentioned to you about these incubators that I set up in that first role, and there was this moment which I have written about, actually, where we had this one team. It was actually the sort of second one that we ran, and we had the perfect team of people, right? They were a nice sort of small size, there were about five of them, I think. They were all subject matter experts, some multidisciplinary, but subject matter experts in what they were doing. So they were all there for a very particular reason. They all had that kind of mindset that I'd said about. They were curious individuals, open-minded, collaborative, interested in learning from each other. And we'd taught them all the best, innovation methodologies. So we'd, immerse them in, how to do problem exploration and customer discovery and how to run experiments. And they'd spent 6 weeks kind of exploring and understanding the problem. And we brought them to a growth board, effectively. I don't think we used that name at the time. And
but an innovation board where people make decisions.
An innovation board where people make decisions. Mm. Exactly. And we brought them in, and they presented basically what they'd learned and what their recommendations were for where they took the project next. And what I then saw was some of the worst leadership behaviors I've ever witnessed, as really all but one, I think, of the leaders in the room really didn't listen to anything that the team said. Pretty much responded with, yeah, but I've got this idea in my head, so I think, why don't you just go and do that? And it was just, it was an absolute car crash. And one of my biggest regrets was just not stopping it earlier. As I, you know, because as this started to unfold, because the team walked out of there absolutely dejected, demoralized. I think all of them kind of quit the team, didn't want to continue working on the project. And for me, it was just an absolute low moment, because I was just like, Christ, we train the team, we forgot to train the leaders in how to actually manage innovation and respond to this stage of exploration that we were in. And so for me, that was, you know, it was a very hard moment, but a massive learning for me. And when I went on to be head of innovation at the Foreign Office, one of the first things I did actually was to develop an awareness and education program for leadership. To help them understand that difference between those worlds of explore and exploit, because they are very reactive organizations, effectively, you know, they are used to focusing on kind of the nearest crocodile to the canoe, and they're not really looking at the horizon too much. And that's what they've been trained to do.
The
in
nearest
their kind
crocodile
of day-to-day
to the
work.
Canoe.
Yeah.
That's new to me.
Someone said to me the other day, we're always looking at the nearest crocodile to the canoe and we don't see the tsunami on the horizon.
Hilarious.
And I was just like, yes, perfect. That is exactly it.
Short-term thinking.
Needing immediate results.
Why is that? I've got a question there. Like in corporates, it's clearly intrinsic because people get rewarded by quarterly results and things like that, right?
Yeah.
And the tenure of a CEO is over, you know, by the time anything new hits the market and so on, like kind of, right? And then boards are not much better governed, you know, like the entire system is not really set up to think long term.
Yeah.
But how is that? Why is that translating so well in government? Is that because of the election cycles or?
Yeah. So I guess there's one thing I would caveat it with is that it's probably particularly acute in the area of government that I worked in, because just the focus was more on near-term issues.
Yeah. And real big problems, right?
So absolutely. Yeah. But yeah, absolutely. You know, the whole political cycle, so the government cycle. But yeah, I think a lot of it really was down to the sort of the nature of the work and the fact that it was generally sort of more reactive a lot of the time. So I think that is why. But yeah, absolutely. I it is very similar in corporate, you know, that are driven by, you know, sort of short-term profit over kind of long-term strategy. And, you know, I find that really, really, you know, interesting. I'm a big fan of Simon Sinek's latest book, The Infinite Game, which I think talks about that really nicely, actually, about the difficulties in sort of focusing on that long-term. So just to carry on that story then, so I did develop some training for senior leaders around, you know, both to give them some actually practical tools, but also help them with that mindset and understanding around, well, what's the difference when we're exploring uncertainty and navigating uncertainty compared to, you know, when we are just in sort of execution mode. And it was really well received, actually. It went down really well. Lots of people were like, yes, like this makes sense to me. I get this. But what I then found still was application was really hard in the context of the organization, which kind of rewarded people for their piece of the pie, effectively, you know, so quite siloed, hierarchical organizations. And in that context, even when I was working one-to-one with certain leaders, I could see how hard it was really to be brave enough to say, no, I'm not going to do that because this piece of work, this longer term thinking piece of work, this more strategic piece of work is more important and it's going to give us the answers we need. Do you know what I mean? And I just you know, and that's the thing that sort of really struck me was, you know, I'd be working with someone who completely got it, wanted to do it, and was still really struggling in practice to kind of implement and change their behavior in the context of, you know, that organizational culture. And, you know, I experienced it myself, right? You know, so I was under pressure as well, you know, to for the team to do, to engage in certain things, to help certain units when, you know, and there was a point with the team I was leading where, you know, it was great. We were sort of in demand and there were different parts of the organization that wanted our help and support. But actually there was a moment I was like, I need to pause a minute and think about what are we trying to achieve as a team? Like, what's our vision for the future of this organization and the role of innovation within it? What's our strategy for achieving that? And are the things that we're doing, all these activities that we're endlessly engaged in, are they taking us any closer to that vision or not? And we were just on this treadmill, you know, I was like most leaders, spent most of my time in meetings, like just running from one thing to the other. And there was a point I was just like, I took a day a week, which I blocked off and I had to defend really ruthlessly, which was my thinking day, to like look at what we were doing, where we were going, where we, you know, engaged in the right initiatives. I had to start, you know, much heavier prioritization, and it was really hard to do. It was hard to defend my time to do any thinking. It was hard to say no to certain things. And, you know, and yeah, it really made me sort of realize how hard that was. And I was fortunate that I had a fantastic coach to help me with some of that work, because I wasn't, you know, really getting that from my leadership. You know, I was under pressure from them as much as anywhere else. But I had a fantastic coach who helped me, both with some of the sort of dynamics, team dynamic issues that I was dealing with at the time, but also with that creating space for, you know, for me to do some thinking and some strategy work. And
so your retreat is part of that, where you say,
absolutely, just
get
absolutely.
Out, physically get out. And
so we just lurch, you know, we're just programmed to lurch from one thing to the next. And, you know, we have this sort of narrative, internal narrative, external narrative, that, you know, if we're not tearing around like crazy people, you know, then we're not being productive, or, you know, we're not important. You know, the busier we are, the more important we must be, yeah. And we feel, you know. And, yeah. You know, the thing is, you know, if as a senior leader, if you're not doing the strategic thinking, if you're not taking some space and time to reflect on where are we trying to go, like, what are we doing? Is that helping us get there? What's my role in this? How are my behaviors helping or not? You know, as a senior leader, if you're not doing that, no one's doing that. And we have to create space for that type of thinking. And that leads on to then creating some space and time for innovation exploration. So for me, so with the retreats, there's something very much around just that creating of some space. And so one of the balancing acts for us with the retreats is very much how much are we doing things in them, and how much are we, you know, running exercises, and how much time actually do we give people to just think, to journal, to take a walk. You know, so it's that balancing act between those two things, where we're sort of stimulating and inspiring and pushing people, but that time to actually then just calm and reflect and, you know, let the thoughts and the creativity flow a little bit more.
How Slack makes you productive.
Absolutely. And there's definitely something as well, you know, I guess what I always found, you know, so one thing I, you know, it is, so we haven't really got into it yet, but we've touched on it, you know, how leading change, innovation, transformation in organizations that don't really at their heart probably want to change or transform, how difficult that is, right? And what a lonely place that is. And
if I may add to that, ideally they don't need to.
Yes. You mean they feel they don't need to?
No, in a sense, like, I mean, when we think about a for-profit business.
Yes.
I mean, what a dream, not having to change for the next 90 years. And I just put my money in there.
Yeah.
Like, and I know it's going to come forever.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I'm not even opposed to that. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. And even more so, actually, if it is working right now, you know, if the money is rolling in, even less of an incentive, right, to do anything, to just explore potential.
It's just not the reality, right? So.
No. The challenge of, I guess, trying to shift organizational culture, right? And it's incredibly hard. And every day to me felt, there were highs and lows, to be honest. You know, it felt that there were moments when I thought, oh my goodness, I'd hear someone say something and I'd think, oh, like they, without any prompting, they've talked about, you know, who's the main customer for this and have we understood, you know, their problems well enough? Or I'm like, oh my God, we're like, things are changing, like the conversation's changing. People are starting to think about these things automatically. And the next minute that something would happen, I'd just be like, oh man, we've made no progress whatsoever. Conversation with like policy or security, who were just like, well, you know, why do you even want to talk to these people outside of our organization? And it was just like, oh, you know, or commercial, who were like, oh, you know, it's going to take about 12 months to get them through, you know, the pipeline. And I guess what I found, it's a bit like being a mom, actually, a parent, is I felt every day I was giving so much of myself. And I was so invested, so emotionally invested. And I think the emotional toll was at times on me, when you care about the future of your organization, you can see if certain changes aren't made, that future could be precarious. And every day you're struggling to shift that conversation, like the tiniest amount. And what I found I needed was things that I always called it, like, I need to fill my cup back up. And I think, you know, it's not just a case of those roles, but I do think once you reach a certain level of seniority in an organization, I think a lot of it is about it. You know, if you're doing it half well, it is about give. And what fills your cup back up, you know, you have to find those other sources quite often. And so for me, again, that's another big element of the retreats, is whether it's the other people, the connection to other people, and hearing about their experiences and finding some kind of solidarity in that, you know, the connection to nature and how that reinvigorates us. But it is very much as well about, like, filling ourselves before we can then go back and give. Well, who do innovation, who initiate change, who challenge the status quo, who they're always looking for things. They know things can always be better, no matter how good they are. So your question about, well, if something's working, why change it? Because it can always be better, you know, or there's another opportunity.
That's just my Warren Buffett style investment thought. Yeah. When it comes to the money I already have banked. that's all.
Let's protect that. But what else? You know, there's always, I think that's the question. These people are always like, what else? What more? And, you know, and yeah, don't just accept that, you know, the status quo is the way it has to be. But it does mean, challenging, like, the comfort and convenience of the status quo. It does mean challenging people on deep-seated beliefs and assumptions. And people don't thank you for that most of the time. So some people, and I guess each time I actually took on one of those roles, I was kind of invited into one of those roles by a senior advocate, right? Yeah. So they brought me in specifically to do that because they wanted that.
And you had a level of protection there for yourself.
You have a level of protection. Right. What I found, though, every time, the moment that senior leader moved on, that vanished.
Wow.
And it completely changes your ability to kind of operate without that kind of senior cover. One person I was speaking to, and I was asking her, you know, about her journey in innovation. She'd started as a project manager, and she said, you know, when she started as a PM, it was all, you know, very defined. This is the project, just can you deliver it, please? And, you know, she'd ask, you know, well, what's the outcome that we're looking for from this? And she said, time after time, no one could articulate to her what the impact was that we were expecting to get from a project. And she's like, I wasn't like questioning it, but surely someone should be able to tell me. And I guess that was it. You know, it wasn't so much that it was just, so it was really around, again, almost like coming from that questioning, well, what's the impact we expect to get, you know, and how are we going to know if we've achieved that? So it was almost about, you know, wanting to just do well. And it was that curiosity and questioning. You know, other people would just go, okay, here's my remit, here's my project, get on and deliver. You know, it might not even occur to a lot of people to ask that question. And so I think maybe it is, I think that is probably the overriding thing, is just that questioning, exploratory mind that's just wondering.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
I've got this other thought. And again, like, I don't know if I'm going too far, but like I read once that 20% of managers in procurement or something have sociopathic tendencies or something like
right.
that. I'm trying to mild that, you know. And I'm like, I'm so sorry if that impacts any relationship with anybody in procurement right now. Like, you should assume anybody's part of the other 80% and the research design isn't done well. So please let's do that. But like, I kind of makes me think or makes me wonder, you know, around this whole topic. There you would think that means they don't care about other people so much. That seems to be one of the traits of that condition, you know. I don't want to sound like I'm a seasoned psychologist here. And you know, may elevate again to support that really poorly right now with a really poor scientific approach, but you know, with some data, like maybe to support that thoughting. And if you care less, you know, you make it further in, then you can also like maybe have it easier to explore relationships rather than building lasting relationships, you know, win-win situations and actually caring, you know, like, because what are all these organizations for, especially government organizations, if it's not for everybody? You know, and
so I can't tell you how many times I have wished I just didn't care. My life is so much easier. And I was talking to someone else about the other day who said to me, you know, he's trying to lead, you know, agile and lean transformation inside a very sort of similar organization. And he said, I've been close to tears so many times. It's emotionally draining on me. He said, you know, he'd been thinking about how could he retrain himself to care a bit less. And you really care about something and you can't shift it. You know, it really does take its toll. And if you haven't got support structures in place around you, wherever they're coming from, that's, you know, incredibly hard. You know, and one thing I would say, a lot of the people I have spoken to, you know, it has actually, you know, affected like mental health as well. You know, it draws so much on your personal resilience to keep going when nothing is in your favor.
It gives me physical pain sometimes, these kind of situations.
It does. I remember a moment, one of the organizations I was working with, and I mean, it sounds really sad. But I had this moment where I thought, I don't think I can change this organization. I don't think it is capable of reform to the extent that it needs. And I don't think it has a future. And at that moment, I felt like, it sounds really radical to say this, but I felt like almost I had like a terminally ill patient on my hands. And I had gone from being like the doctor, he was, you know, trying to come up with different ways we could reverse. It wasn't terminal, so as that we could cure in a way, to almost accepting, well, it is terminal now. So I almost then became like a hospice nurse, where I was like, how do I now make them comfortable in their final days? And it was like a heartbreaking realization, actually. And that was the analogy that came to me, was this is what it feels like to me. That's now tough. That I can't do anything more for this organization. Like I'm gonna have to make my peace with that. And it was incredibly hard. Emotional, really. I think what kept me going was people. And it might, quite a lot of the time, it was the team I was working with. That's where I would get energy from. It's where I would get support from, understanding from, motivation, inspiration. Sometimes, you know, I was lucky, like certainly at the beginning of all of those roles I did, I had a leader who had my back, who gave me space, who helped me navigate the politics and the complexities, who took barriers out of my way, who trusted me and let me run. Every time I lost one of those leaders, that was incredibly difficult. Because, you know, certainly in a couple of the situations, what I ended up with was almost the biggest barrier to me succeeding was my manager. And my biggest barrier to the team being able to make progress was my manager's mindset. And that's really demotivating, really hard.
Yeah.
And then the other place, you know, I guess it was that external, you know, so I, you know, when 2020 and COVID hit, I found that really hard because, you know, I would always go to a couple of conferences a year. I always loved meeting people from, you know, different industries because, you know, like I say, like everyone actually, no matter what kind of industry people were from, like their context actually wasn't often that different at all. They were facing exactly the same challenges. You know, sometimes we'd have conversations and we'd talk about what we were doing and they'd be like, my God, I can't believe you're doing that. I'd never be able to do that. And I'd like think, oh, we are making progress. We're not that far behind,
yeah,
you know, and that would fill you up and give you faith and confidence, you know, and, you know, you'd see other people talk about things. You think, oh, I could try that, you know. So I would say for me, people, you know, whether it was my team, whether it was a leader, whether it was people outside of my organization, they were the things that would always keep me going. And, you know, if or some chink of hope from inside, you know, I might be at that point where I just thought, I'm done, you know, I can't do anything. This is done, I'm done. And then something would happen and it would just be like that glimmer of hope. And then it would like reignite sort of the fire, I guess, to keep going.
So when you were in that, do you call it palliative care?
Is that, palliative care, yeah.
But so you did not, you did not quit then, you did not.
Well, I did at that point. So, I mean, I carried on, I guess, for a while. Once I had that realization, it was probably about another 6 to 12 months I carried on in that particular organization. But yeah, I did leave that organization. because, that wasn't who I was. I'm not a hospice nurse. So at that point, I was in a really challenging position at that point. So I'd had that realization around the organization. I didn't have any leadership kind of air cover whatsoever. I had a direct manager who was incredibly tactical, siloed, sort of thinking, I'm willing to listen, explore, be open-minded. So that was like a day-to-day challenge. And I also had been some changes in my team, and I wasn't even getting the energy like I used to get from the team. So for me at that point, it was kind of like, if I don't leave now, this is actually, it was affecting my well-being. And it wasn't sustainable, I didn't feel, for me. But that in itself, this recognition that, I can't be effective here anymore, I don't think. That's a really hard moment as well, to sort of realize that and make that decision. But it was definitely the right decision to move on. I could have more impact elsewhere, actually still working closely with that organization, but from a different angle.
Yeah, and things change, right? It's just the time horizon has been bloody long, but suddenly there's again this one person.
Yeah.
And suddenly everything changes from micromanaging away to trust based, and from this to that. Yeah. And suddenly there's space and room. And it's just the impact of that variable is tremendous, right? Yeah.
It's tremendous. And, when all these, I've spoken now, done interviews with around, I think, about 12, 15 people. And this theme comes up time and time again around if you are a kind of a corporate explorer, right? Someone who's leading change and innovation inside an organization, the importance of having someone who has your back, who's more senior than you, is absolutely pivotal. And people manage it as well. Even if their direct line manager isn't that sort of person, but there's someone above them, they always circumvent the line manager, they find a way around it. But the moment there's no one who's more senior than them, who has their back, who will give them space, it makes their job almost impossible. And I guess, that would be, one of the things I sort of want to pull out of this is for people that are in senior leadership positions, who how can you spot these corporate explorers and how can you support and enable them? Because I think they
first you have to be able to actually find them, right? And that's kind of
you have to find them. I think they're usually pretty self-identifying.
No, what I mean is, what I meant was that if senior leadership is not actually enabled to find them, they are everywhere. I'm with you. Yes. Nobody, please go out and try to hire Elon Musk or something like that, right? Yeah. Wannabes. You have people in your organization, I'm pretty sure. But that is that seems to be very, very tricky, right? To unlearn leadership and relearn in leadership and to look for those and create different incentive structures, right? Would you say that is?
One of the things I've discovered is, in these conversations, so talking to the corporate explorers and learning about the people who enabled them and protected them, a common characteristic of those people is either they're at a point in their career or they're just of that mind where they're basically thinking, I'm going to do the right thing. I don't care anymore. And that does seem to be the defining characteristic, is when leaders can worry more about the people they're looking after and the impact they're creating than worry about their own career, that's when then people below them flourish. And that's just it. So, one person I spoke to, actually, he was about to leave the company. And he said to me, he asked several people, if you were me, who is the one senior leader you'd go and work for? And the same name kept coming up. And he said, I approached this guy and I said, I want to come and work for you. Otherwise, you know, I'm leaving, find a way. And yeah, he did. And, you know, and actually I would say I was not, when I left that job, not in a dissimilar situation. You know, I had reached a point where I was like, well, I'm going to, you know, leave, or I find someone I can work for, because, you know, it is hard enough doing what I'm trying to do without, you know, having someone on your case every day who's trying to get you to do the opposite. So I think there's something about us as well that's probably quite unmanageable and hard to manage. But yeah, they are, I do believe, frankly, they are few and far between in my experience. And that was one thing, you know, another conversation I had with someone, I said, when I was asking the question around who do you look to for support? And he said, well, you know, I do look to leadership. He said, but to be honest, looking for inspirational leaders, he said, like, there are very few that I see. They're pretty special where they exist.
Yeah. Yeah,
and a lot of this
triggers a lot for me that I'm.
It does. I guess a lot of it has to do with psychological safety, you know. So obviously, you know, it's a big enabler for innovation, but it's huge. I think people often talk about psychological safety, you know, lower down in the organization, and do we empower people lower down the organization to raise concern, to bring ideas up, and. That's hugely important. But I guess where I've been looking is at the top of the organization and the lack of psychological safety there. And if there's no psychological safety there, well, that's just going to trickle all the way down, right? And often psychological safety is severely lacking at the top of an organization.
Yes.
Because of those siloed structures that we have, because there are less positions and people are fighting for them, right?
The stakes are higher.
The stakes are super high. And you know, and again, that whole incentive and reward structure is, you know, about my silo, my piece of the pie. You know, there is very little safety, and you know, getting them to sort of show any vulnerability or any degree of kind of honesty actually can be really hard. And you know, I do think, like, you know, working on some of those senior leadership team dynamics and developing greater levels of, you know, trust at that level, you know, it's really important.
Yeah, this is awesome. Like, I for those who listen to a few of these episodes, this must have come up before, because I just talk about it all the time. But, like, you know, we historically, sort of my background, we started helping teams going faster, you know, to learn the right thing at the right time, to build, you know, small things and all that jazz. And then, yeah, so they learn how to, you know, use some of those tools, identify their assumptions, you know, be vulnerable in that world as well, you know, because you say, okay, I'm actually not sure about this, right? It's like it's a vulnerability there, you know. And and then so what? It doesn't really mean much, because, you know, okay, you may be able to explore a few things before you write that business case, but you still have to write a business case with tons of uncertainty, and that still has to be approved in the same mechanisms, and then you have to execute it, right? And then you sort of go to the next level, and you go to the next level, and it kind of never ends. And you know, unless the explore side, if there is even one, is funded properly, on the long, with the long vision, and people are rewarded appropriately, and is somehow untangled from quarterly results or budget cycles or so on. It's just really hard to consistently have, you know, have lots of tries and lots of bets that we need in order to find those high risk, high reward initiatives.
But then
it comes to really, like, you know, boards, and it comes to shareholders, really, and like how we, like, at least in the for-profit world, and how can we even inform them and in long-term strategy and things like that. So I feel like trying to relate that to government and to things that we just said, at least to a degree. I mean, you know, we go up and up and up, and somehow, you know, unless goal setting in senior leadership, unless long-term vision in senior leadership is not installed, we can remove a lot of problems. We can add a lot of value where products are developed, where services are developed, where policies are rewritten, and so on. But being successful at scale for a long period of time, there seems to be ultimately this limiting factor that will be sitting there, chilly. And that's
the thing, is that mindset of never sitting on your laurels, I think, you know. And, you know, the advantage that an established organization has over a startup is that it has huge, incredibly valuable assets at its disposal. You know, it's got a workforce, it's got, you know, customers, it's got a platform, it's got a reputation. Like, those are all things that can be leveraged. And it's just about, you know, delivering on that, you know, that ambidextrous organization, being able to deliver on the core, keep the money coming in, and explore, like, you know, the future and potential. And it's just very hard, I think, for people to divert resource away from the kind of the money-making part of the machine, isn't it? And it doesn't. So one other mistake I've seen quite often, I think, is, you know, when organizations sort of embark on like a particular digital transformation, it's almost like, you know, the messaging goes out like, you know, we're changing, you know, this is how we're going to be, and everyone needs to be involved in this, and everyone needs to be thinking about the future. And I don't agree with that at all. You know, it's like, well, we're going to have absolute chaos if everyone's like innovating and thinking about the future. You know, actually,
and you're creating heart attacks more than ever.
Yeah. And, you know, and I've seen that as well. You know, like one of you know, talking to people, you know, former colleagues in one of the organizations I used to work for, you know, and they're like, you know, they're on the line, you know, delivering, you know, stuff that is here and now, right? And it's really important that it's done and delivered here and now. And they're really resentful, actually, because they're kind of like, well, I'm busting my gut every day to do this. And all I hear about is, oh, it's not good enough. Think about the future. And it's kind of, and I completely understand that. And they, frankly, should be left in peace to deliver today. But there does need to be people who have the mindset and the skills and the interest and the curiosity to explore the future simultaneously. And you know, and I think, you know, that's where sort of people sort of like they lurch from like one extreme to the other, you know, we're all here and now. Oh no, we've all got to be thinking about the future. And then something will happen and it's like, quick, let's all get back to now because something's happened and we've got to protect it. You know, and it's just like this organizational lurching all over the place, which is exhausting, you know, and nonsensical. But yeah, your point around, you know, this connection to, you know, vision and strategy, you know, is for me, you know, so those three things, you know, so I talk about innovation, I talk about leadership, and I talk about strategy, because the three for me are absolutely interconnected. And you cannot sort of have one really without the other. And, you know, that's, we've talked a lot about the leadership piece, but the strategic piece, you know, we have touched on, but, you know, that is so important, to understand like what is our vision and look at what are we, you know, how are we, you know, how do we think we're going to achieve that? What are we currently doing? And what's working about that? That's taking stock, you know, and that has to be done. And it's not the sort of thing, you know, we always have these like, oh, we're going to have, you know, like a 2-day offsite with the senior leadership team where we're going to do strategy. Yeah. And it's like, no, that's just, you know.
What doesn't work about it?
2 days is enough. enough.
Not enough, right.
You barely scratched the surface, and it's continuous. Yeah. This is the thing people often think, right, let's spend 2 days coming up with a new strategy and then we'll just go and implement it. And that's not, you know, the reality now is that that's just not how it's going to work. But yeah, no, it's, you know, there needs to be, you know, a regular cadence to kind of understanding, you know, and putting those leading indicators in place and looking at, well, you know, an analysis and assessment of, well, what are we doing? And is it getting us closer? And have we got the leading indicators? And are we changing track now or not? Are we going to, you know, persevere with this strategy? Or, you know, what else has changed now in our environment? You know, and stuff's changing all the time.
And that goes back to vulnerability saying my strategy is not correct anymore, at least.
Maybe never was, or not is anymore, right?
And that's that vulnerability in senior leadership that unless you have that, you just run tons of resources down the drain, you know?
So Tristan and I wrote this article on adaptive strategy, you know, and the whole essence of that article is everything about that is, you know, it is really now strategy is nothing more than our hypothesis about, you know, our best guess at that point in time with the data that we've got available to us on how we think we can achieve a certain outcome, you know, and it is our responsibility to know if the strategy we're taking is working or not, and if, or the environment's changed and we need to adapt that. And, you know, I mean, it's not like, you know, we're doing this weekly or something, but there does need to be an agreed cadence and it does, and you have to sort of, you know, be open to that. And,
well,
and
remind the organizations me of the sorry, yeah, this is what I'd love to zoom in there if you could note up on that for a second. The cadence is something that, you know, we don't really have sort of good data on it, different industries, different circumstances. Like could we talk about that for a second?
I guess the cadence really depends on what your industry is and what the environment is like in which you're operating. You know, if it is a pretty stable industry and environment, then, you know, you probably don't need to do it quite so often. But if you're in an environment that is changing a lot, then it is something that you're going to have to, you know, have a more regular cadence. And the adaptation, you know, I guess it's not necessarily, you know, like throwing the bathwater out with the baby. It is about tweaks. It's about doubling down on, you know, it's like any kind of innovation, actually. It's about doubling down on what is working. And it's about pivoting what isn't. And it's about making data-informed decisions about what we do and don't do. But so often it's nothing more than, oh, you know, we've got an idea, let's just do it. And, you know, just we plow so much resource into like big bets that are completely unproven in a strategic context, you know, as well as an innovation context.
So the next part had to be cut out because the episode just became too long and we had to make some sacrifices. But what Susie and I continue to explore here was the topic of an adaptive strategy or an agile strategy. If you want to learn more about it, I recommend you to go to the show notes and check out the article that Susie wrote on this topic. Enjoy the next part.
How did we end up here?
We started talking about strategy, didn't we? And
I think it really goes back to the very beginning, talking about your retreats. How long are your retreats?
They're like 2 nights, 2 days, sometimes a bit longer, 3 days, 3 nights. That's kind of average. I'd love to do some slightly longer ones, but yeah, it's just about, you know, whether people can sort of find
the time
and space for that.
So you do that over the weekend then, or do you try to get out of the week?
So try to get out of the weekend, actually, particularly, well, it depends on what the topic is, and if it's something that kind of companies are sending people on, or if it's something that people are sort of doing more for themselves. But usually kind of like ideally starting like a Sunday night, actually, you know, and then finishing on the sort of Tuesday night, Wednesday morning, feels like a good sort of way to like help people ease in. I guess three words, you know, it's that kind of, it's pressing the reset button, it's re-energizing, and then I also like to think of it as re-emerging, like, you know, with clarity and perspective on your next steps, you know, and I do think that's, you know, for anyone in any leadership position, let alone if you're sort of managing kind of innovation or, you know, high uncertainty situations. I think, you know, that ability to just take a moment to pause, to reflect, to fill your cup back up, you know, and reemerge from that with more energy and more clarity on, you know, on how you're going to lead, you know, just stop a moment, that relentless sort of, you know, lurching from one thing to the next, which is not good for you. It's not good for the organization. It's not good for the people, you know, that you're leading.
Breaks so, make you productive.
Yeah, absolutely. People end up in leadership positions because they just, you know, it's just like the progression. It's just like the next step, right? The next promotion, more money. And, you know, for me, leadership is an absolute privilege. And like when, you know, we've all had leaders that have made and broken us. If you haven't had a leader that's broken you, well, you're very lucky. And so you know what that feels like. So if you're in that position, know that impact you're having on others. And I just think that is an overwhelming position of responsibility. And one to be taken seriously and one to make sure that we're in the best possible, whether it's the skills we've got, you know, our energy levels, like we have to make sure we're equipped for it.
Yeah. So at this point, a cut had to be made again. I had to cut something out because the episode just became too long. But what we did here was to talk about the concept of a peer learning or self-help group for corporate innovators. We've been toying with that idea for a while. I assume we will just be recording another episode on this topic and make up for that. Okay, enjoy the rest of the episode. Oh, and also if you're interested in that topic, yeah, maybe get in touch and, you know, try to make it happen even earlier. Okay.
Yeah, but yeah, I'd love to do that together. I also think we should have your retreats in Australia.
I can
plug that here. I've got a friend who has a beautiful retreat, Gaimia retreat. He's got a perfect retreat in northern New South Wales.
It's wow. It is
magic. Give me any reason to go there anyway.
Amazing.
yeah. Yeah. I think that would be also cool.
Absolutely. I'm all up for that.
Yeah. Thank you, Susie.
Well, thank you. No, I appreciate the opportunity. I actually always find it really cathartic myself having these conversations.
Yeah.
It's a bit like the reason why I write, actually, is it is cathartic. It helps me make sense of some of my thoughts and experience, you know. And similarly, it's a bit like that concept of a support group. There is the cathartic sort of decompression, and there's also the, you know, the inspiration, you know, as like we sort of bounce ideas and like explore, well, why is that? So I really appreciate the opportunity.